Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Ken is unfortunately out this week, not feeling too well. So my guest is from Core to Three, the owner and head guy, Tom Chick.
Hello, my name is Tom Chick, and my game of the week is not... Do we not do that here, Josh?
No, we don't.
Ah, rats. I was so ready with a not game of the week.
No, we do things a little differently here.
Where's the music, by the way? Where's the kicking beats, Josh?
I don't have that. I don't spend the time thinking of cool music to have on, unfortunately. I'd love to have my own, like, catchy theme song, but I am not the musically inclined to do that.
Do you want me to sing something for you, Josh?
Yeah, sure.
No, the correct answer to that is no, I don't. Trust me, that's the correct answer to that.
Same when people ask me to sing, too.
Yeah, when we're playing Guitar Hero, Josh, neither you or I is going to take up that mic, are we?
Nope, we are not.
What do you do, by the way, on Guitar Hero? Let's say we're all four playing. We need a bassist, a guitar player. We need a drummer. Someone's going to sing. It's not going to be one of us. Which one are you going to go for? Can I guess? And then you tell me if I'm right.
Sure.
Josh Beiser goes for the bass.
Yeah, pretty much. One of the two guitars. I've tried the drums, and it's just because of the problem I have in my right leg. I just cannot drum. I can't hit the kick thing, which I can't even remember right now off the top of my head.
It's the kick thing. You're right. It's the kick thing. Pedal, I believe.
There we go. So, for those of you who weren't paying attention last week, we couldn't really have a cast because we all weren't feeling too well. I know, Tom, you weren't feeling too well last week.
Yeah, I had some sort of a head cold, flu, plague, bubonic sort of thing that I'm snapping out of now. Can't believe Ken is such a baby that he won't join us because now he feels sick. Oh, my God.
Yeah, normally this cast is rain or shine, sick or healthy. You got to do it.
That's right.
And I was telling Tom before the cast, I haven't, knock on wood, I haven't been getting too much sick since I stopped working at Comcast 2 years ago, which was just, you know, the melding pot of disease over there, because everyone's, you know, touching keyboards, and it's like 90 degrees in there. And I kid you not, there was a time where once a week an ambulance was called in to help someone while I was working there, which is always great for morale.
You make, I was going to say Hugh Hefner. Who's the guy who's the notorious germaphobe? That had the spruce goose, Hugh Laurie, Hugh Hewell, Hugh Hauser. What the heck was that guy's name? Hugh, dadgummit. Oh, it sucks getting near 50. I can't remember that guy's name. Come on, he's the spruce goose guy. Josh, you're way younger than me. You should be able to think of this stuff, you know, like that. Come on, Josh.
Howard Hughes.
Howard Hughes. Okay, that's my problem. You were making Howard Hughes sound eminently reasonable when you were describing your workplace. That sounds pretty gross.
Yeah, and I got like really bad, like one time I got really bad eye infection. I was just out for 2 weeks straight. And then since then, the only other time I got sick was all of a sudden I was feeling fine, and then it hit me, and I was just freezing cold and like paralyzed in my bed for like 8 hours. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what happened. I actually got my allergy shot that day, and then I was just, you know, on death's door for like one day, and then I woke up the next morning perfectly fine. I just like literally like hopped out of bed ready to go. So
one of my peak gaming experiences from the last, I don't know, 5 years was being deathly ill and having a fever and just sort of curled up in bed with that, oh God, I want to die kind of thing for 3 days. And in the course of that, playing the Resident Evil on the 3DS. I forgot what it was. Resident Evil Curiosities or Resident Evil...
Revelations.
Thank you, Josh. And it so colored the experience of that particular Resident Evil that I couldn't imagine playing it not feverishly. So I highly recommend that. If you're ill this flu season, just play through some game, preferably something trippy in Japanese, and you'll enjoy it that much more.
Mm-hmm. It would be awesome to play a game like Rez when you're like having a fever and hallucinating, because that would just make that game amazing. But...
Yep, that might trip some weird thing where you would completely like go over to the other side, though. So exercise caution, anyone who does that.
Mm-hmm. And it may actually help playing like Resident Evil 6 or Dead Space
3. No, Josh, nothing can help Resident Evil 6.
sad, I guess. I tried, the last one I played was Resident Evil 5. I only got like an hour in before I just got bored of it. So let's begin with some news. And for me, I'll start with talking briefly about the Video Game Expo, Video Game Awards. I don't even know what Spike TV's calling anymore. But apparently that was a thing this weekend. Tom, did you watch any of it?
Can't say as I did. Can't say as I can help you say much about it. I believe, though, that it is called They just go by VGX now? Is that the deal?
I guess so. I don't know what the X stands for, but maybe it's one of the, those cool things.
Extreme, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, this was an awards ceremony. It used to be, is this what used to be the Spike Video Game Awards, that thing?
Yeah, and then okay. Originally it was the Tech TV or G4 Awards show.
Mm.
And
why didn't you watch it, Josh?
Well, one, I didn't know it was streaming live. I thought it was going to be on TV. Mm-hmm. I went to turn on Spike, and it was just a cops marathon.
Mm-hmm.
Which, incidentally, is the same thing that happens if you turn on G4 during the day. It's either cops or some other show. They just, like, rerun that constantly. And the second thing, I heard that, well, after the show, people were talking about how crappy it was. It was hosted by Joel McHale, who does The Soup. He's on E! He also does that show Community, which I'm going to admit that I have not watched that show yet.
Mm-hmm.
And also by Jeff Knightley.
Keeley. You're thinking of Keira Knightley. I think Jeff Keeley is constantly confused with Keira Knightley. One of them was in Pirates of the Caribbean. One of them, Shills Doritos.
And Mountain Dew, don't forget that.
Right, oh gosh, yeah, exactly. How can I forget?
And so the show, they've been putting up YouTube clips of, you know, condensing all the worst moments down, which keep getting taken down by Viacom. And just watching those, like, 6-7 minutes was enough. Apparently the show was, like, a 2 or 3 hour show.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they only had, like, 8 or 9 different categories. So I guess it was sort of like the Oscars, going on way too long.
Do they have musical numbers and whatnot? Is there, like, entertainment or anything? Or I guess there's probably a lot of clips. You know what it is, Josh? They also announce things, right? Like, there were a few, the announcement that Telltale was doing a Game of Thrones and a Borderlands title. Weren't those both announced last night?
Yeah, they announced that, and they announced that Elijah Wood is going to be one of the characters on Broken Age.
Mm-hmm.
And don't know if they actually had any musical numbers. They've had, you know like, hard rock and, like, rap groups on in the past, but I don't know if they actually did anything streaming. They had, really don't know, honestly.
We're probably the worst guys to be talking about this. Do we know anything that won?
Of course, Grand Theft Auto 5 won. I think it won Game of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly, Gone Home was mentioned. It won Best Indie.
Mm-hmm. Why is that surprising?
That Spike would actually recognize Gone Home as a game.
What is there any? Because if you call out indies, you kind of have to. There's a small enough pool to draw from for someplace like Spike, I guess. That like what's the other indie that would have any mainstream cred this year? I don't really know.
They did mention the Stanley Parable and Papers, Please.
Oh, okay.
That was pretty nice to have those on. No mention of Sangfroid, but then again, I doubt most people know what Sangfroid was.
Right, that's a tough one.
Yeah, I didn't even know about it until you mentioned it on 4-3.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I played it a few weeks ago, and it was pretty fun, but yeah, probably a game that came and went very quickly.
Probably no mention of, like, Occult Chronicles, which is Vic Davis's thing, or Bionic Dues, the latest from Chris Park's group. Yeah, it seems like there's this kind of this top tier of indies, and it's games that play the whole, hey, we know how to get publicity game. You know, they know that whole grind. So yeah, I guess Stanley Parable, Gone Home. What was the third one you mentioned? Oh, Papers, Please. That gets a lot of attention. Yeah.
Let's see. I brought up the list. So
What else won?
Let's see. Grand Theft Auto 5 won Game of the Year.
Okay.
Studio of the Year was Naughty Dog.
Huh. All right. real quick, Josh, do you have a problem with Grand Theft Auto 5 winning Game of the Year? You okay with that? How do you feel?
I didn't play it, honestly, but I just never found those games to be that interesting. I bought Grand Theft Auto 4 and was just so disappointed by it. The only Rockstar game I think I generally enjoyed was Red Dead.
Okay.
What do you think about Grand Theft Auto 5?
I'm at the point now where I'm thinking about, okay, you know, these are the games that I really loved this year. These are the ones that are kind of bubbling to the top as amongst my favorite. And Grand Theft Auto 5 is easily up there. Like, if I hear someone, the Game of the Year thing is such a personal choice anyway. Mm-hmm. So if I hear someone mention their pick, I'm never like, oh, that's wrong. It says to me more about the person choosing than the actual game a lot of times. But I'm not the least bit surprised that anybody would call out Grand Theft Auto 5 as the best game of the year, whether it's some corporate entity like whatever VGX is supposed to be, or even, you know, just for personal picks. I think it's a tremendous achievement on a lot of levels. And I'm certainly at a point now where I'm thinking, you know, which of the handful of games that really hit me this year, which would I pick as my favorite? And GTA 5 is certainly among them. So.
Yeah, I was thinking about that last night, because I have to come up with my top 10 list for Game Wisdom, and I have a lot of games I think would be like number 2, number 3 on the list, but I have no idea what I'm actually going to decide as my number 1 game. I've gotten to the point where I'm just so critical from looking at games on the site that every game that I think of, there's always like some caveat to the game that's keeping me from saying, oh, this is my most enjoyed game of 2013.
That's interesting that you put it that way, Josh, because I have no problem with picking as a personal favorite something that's flawed. Another one that I'm struggling with, like, is this my one favorite game of the year? And spoiler, we'll talk about it in a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's a zombie apocalypse game called State of Decay, mm-hmm. which has some design issues that I just hate, and they drive me crazy. And there's currently some bugs that I'm waiting on them to iron out that I'm not going to play it until they fix this. We'll talk more specifics when we talk about our games of the week. But I would have no problem picking that as my favorite game of the year. For me, the sort of caveats don't necessarily impact what level that I enjoyed them on so much as they're just things that I would mention in the course of talking about it. Like, I don't feel like my pick for a game of the year has to be 100% perfect, or it has to work right, or it has to not have flaws, for instance. For me, caveats don't really mean I want to put it at number 2 or number 3.
I'll give you my example, Card Hunter, which was released a few months ago, free to play. Mm-hmm. When I first started playing it, I was loving that game. I was ready to declare it my number 1 game. Mm-hmm. But then I hit that difficulty curve when you get to like level 12 or 13, and it just completely soured my experience. I reached that point where while I was trying to battle my normal level was so hard unless I just got lucky, and I wasn't at the point where I could buy better loot to compensate. So I was sort of stuck between being too strong in some aspect, but being too weak in another, and it just got me to the point where I was just like, I'm done. I can't play this anymore.
It definitely throws a curve at you at that point, doesn't it? It becomes a different kind of game, and it expects you to do different kinds of things than what you'd been doing to get to that point. Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, it's one, like any kind of CCG or collectible card game-based design, it has very hard rules for how attacks will work or how some defenses will, you know, completely nullify one type of damage but will take something else. And if you're not lucky enough to have either a strong enough attack cards or enough cards to sort of circumvent those rules, it just becomes very painful to play, and you really can't get into a grudge fight with the AI because they're always going to have more health and stronger cards than you.
I would suggest, Josh, that it's less about being lucky enough and more about forcing you to go back and really tinker with your characters and your deck in a way that people are reluctant to do if they've been thinking of it as an RPG. Like, you know, I've got this character and he's fitted out with these cards and he should be able to take on any obstacle with this loadout. And that's how you play an RPG, but a CCG, a collectible card game, you know, where you make a new deck, and you take cards out of your deck, you put cards in your deck, like Magic the Gathering, where you're playing against a certain color and you tailor your deck. It takes a shift at that point you're talking about, where you have to stop thinking of it as an RPG and get more into a Magic mindset. And I think after you've been playing, you know, 12, 13 levels of an RPG, it's kind of a bait and switch. Like, hey, this isn't the game that I was playing before. Why do I have to play this now?
Yeah, that's a good point. It definitely has that same feel to it than Ironclad Tactics had, a game from Zachtronics Industries, the guys who did Space Chem. That game is just pure CCG. There's no real RPG side to it. I know a lot of people got frustrated by the fact that you really did have to redesign your deck almost every story mission. And there were a few which I couldn't really see possible being in normally unless you build your deck explicitly for that one specific battle, such as the final boss fight.
That's deck building games for you.
Yep.
What else won at the VGX?
Let's see. So Heroes and Naughty Dog, best shooter was BioShock Infinite.
Awesome. Okay.
I love that we both chuckled at that one.
BioShock Infinite is many things that are impressive, but a shooter is not one of them.
I would agree with you on that one. The runner-ups were Battlefield 4, Call of the Ghosts, and Metro Last Light. I heard Metro was pretty good. I haven't played it.
Metro's excellent, and also I guess you would... I don't know, is Metro an indie game? I guess it's Deep Silver published it. It was THQ, so no, that's not really indie. But yeah, Metro is very good.
Let's see, best action-adventure was Assassin's Creed 4, with the runner-ups apparently Grand Theft Auto 5's and an action-adventure now, and Last of Us and Tomb Raider.
Okay, interesting.
What do you think about Assassin's Creed 4? I haven't played the series since Assassin's Creed 2, the very first one. Mm-hmm.
I think it's the best Assassin's Creed you can play. I like it. I really like how the sailing ship stuff makes it feel substantially different from the previous Assassin's Creeds. I think a lot of us who've played every iteration were getting a little fatigued of parkouring around historical cities. So it's a really nice change of pace to have that ocean-going stuff. The basic structure is kind of a comfortable combination of Sid Meier's Pirates, but dumbed down a bit, and I don't mean that necessarily derogatorily, simplified a bit, to be more like maybe Wind Waker. And it's some of the best, as far, I've played it on the PC, it's some of the best sort of eye candy slash porn you can get with a really nice video card. It's a gorgeous game. I just love booting it up and just running around and getting on the boat and doing stuff. I quite like Assassin's Creed 4. Action-adventure game, huh? All right.
Yeah. That's action-adventure has always been that, like, catch-all genre for the industry. Like, almost any game really can be classified as that.
Let's see,
for, like, first-person shooter. But then again, there was, you know, Metroid Prime had adventure elements.
Right.
See, best sports game, which I guess that's NBA 2K14, and I have, like, nothing to really say there.
Yeah, I'm not much of a baseball fan either.
Uh-huh. See, we talked in the game. The runner-up, surprising, was Kentucky Route Zero. I heard some people talk about that, but I haven't played that one.
Wait, what? Kentucky Round Zero? What are you even saying? What is that?
Kentucky Route Zero.
Kentucky Route? I don't even... What is that? Is that some trail that the settlers used in the 16th century? What?
I have no idea. It's apparently an indie game. Expensive one at that. It looks like it's a season.
Wait, are we still under sports? Is this a sports game?
No, it's indie, apparently.
Kentucky Route Zero. Wow. I think I want to play it.
Looks pretty interesting style-wise, and it was greenlit, but yeah, apparently it got a runner-up on the VGX, so I guess that's good.
Josh, when I say Kentucky, aside from this game, what do you think of?
I think of bourbon for some reason.
All right, no, that's a viable answer. I think, myself, of the TV show Justified. Is that set Kentucky, or did I just screw up? That's Kentucky, right?
I don't know. I've heard of it, but I haven't watched that.
Okay.
Let's see. Best RPG, Ni No Kuni. Runner-ups were Final Fantasy XIV, Fire Emblem, and Pokemon. I don't know if I would consider Fire Emblem an RPG, would you?
I don't know. Are SRPGs RPGs? They kind of have their own category. RPG is almost as nebulous a term, Josh, as shooter.
Yeah. Especially when you got, you know, everything from Diablo.
Guild Wars 2. RPG. Yeah. Right.
Guild Wars 2, that came out last year, right?
Right. Oh, you know what? I guess you could call up Diablo for the console release, couldn't you?
Yeah. I've yet to play Guild Wars 2, but I've heard almost nothing but good things about it.
Okay, hold on, Josh. I'm going to make a list for you. Things you need to play. I'm putting down GTA 5, and then I'm putting Guild Wars 2 underneath it. I'm also going to make a note at the bottom here that you should probably watch Justified. Okay.
All right.
I'll update this as we keep recording.
Yeah, you're going to be doing a lot of edits to that, I think. Final Fantasy 14, that's a surprise. I know that is pretty much Ken's go-to horror game. I think he's mentioned that almost every other cast have done over the last year about how horrible the original Final Fantasy 14 is.
Yeah, if he was here today, he would be getting mad about now, right?
Yeah. Pretty much. He would probably have a 5-minute discussion ready to go right now. Moving on, best fighting game, Injustice Gods Among Us. And runner-ups, Dive Kick, Killer Instinct, and Tekken Revolution.
Jeez. Now, that gets its own category, and then they have to lump in RPGs and action-adventures and all this other stuff in these big, huge umbrellas, and then they have a special umbrella for fighting games.
Yeah.
Josh, what can you tell me about Injustice Gods Among Us?
I've heard good things about it. It's, of course, done by NetherRealm, who were, of course, the original guys who did Mortal Kombat. Ed Boon is, I think, the head guy there.
Do you know what kind of game, like, who the characters are?
I know to some extent, but, and we'll probably talk about this more when we get to our games of the week, but my comic book knowledge is pretty much extensively from all the TV shows and movies. I don't think I've read a comic book in possibly 14, 15 years.
Okay, but you know that it's DC Comics. It's basically like, hey, what if Wonder Woman and Batman got in a fight? It's that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and I know they have some kind of like hand-wavy explanation for how Superman can not, you know, punch the Joker and have explode instantaneously.
Do they? I mean, not really. That one of the cool things about Injustice Gods Among Us, and they tried to do this with Mortal Kombat, Kombat, but I just can't be arsed to care about any Mortal Kombat character. One of the cool things they do with Injustice is they have a kind of a cool storyline. Mm-hmm. And I say this like you, Josh, I don't read comics. I just know about them through the more wider cultural expressions like movies and mm-hmm. stuff these days. But there's kind of a cool story about these superheroes being in an alternate timeline where Superman is the ultimate villain because Lex Luthor killed Lois Lane, and so he's embittered and he's ruling the world as a kind of a tyrant, and so a bunch of the other superheroes have to form a kind of a counter-revolutionary group, and it's just some kind of crazy stuff that I love playing just to see how they're going to make some crazy story beat lead to Aquaman fighting whoever this flying chick is with wings and a mace. You know, I don't know who half these people are, but it's just kind of deliriously over the top. It's imaginative stuff. So I quite like some Injustice and even the storyline stuff.
Yeah, as a quick aside, mm-hmm. I love when they do these types of alternate or these like evil stories for comic book characters, because I love to see just how far they're going to go. I remember Spider-Man Web of Shadow. That was one of my favorite games just because I just played that completely evil, because I just want to see him go, you know, well, how would we make Peter Parker, you know, an evil bastard? And it got pretty, like, crazy by the end. He kills one person. He leads, like, an army to take over the world. And I would love to see them, you know, follow that up with a sequel, just, like, bad guy sequel. I want to see, you know, the good version of that end.
Right, right. So, wow, so you think Spider-Man should be evil and take over the world?
Yes, exactly.
All right.
Good to know. Killer Instinct, I just want to touch on that briefly. I find it interesting. That is the free-to-play Killer Instinct game, and they just released that for Xbox One, I guess, as one of the launch titles.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to see how that's going to actually do, because free-to-play and fighting games really don't mix, I think. But it's going to be crazy, because they're releasing it free, you get one character, and then you can either buy everything separately, or you basically plop down, I think, $60 or $70, and you get, like, the what will be considered the retail version of it.
Yeah, I wonder, will a community coalesce around that? And plus, it's a launch title on a, you know, on a next-gen system. Are people just going to say, ah, forget that, we've already got, you know, whatever we're currently playing on our Xbox 360 or PS3? Yeah, who knows? I don't have any frame of reference, by the way, for what the heck Killer Instinct is.
That is from Super Nintendo era Rareware.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they went way back and dug something up and decided this is going to be our exclusive licensed Xbox One launch fighting game. Okay. Who are the main, who's a notable character? Isn't there an alligator or something? Who are the notable characters in Killer Instinct?
That I really have no idea about. All right. I know there's a robot, a werewolf.
Werewolf, that's what I think what I was thinking of. Is the werewolf the one you get free? Do we know?
You get some, like, ninja guy. Looks like, I don't even know. I don't know if, like, he has, like, giant muscles.
Okay.
Like, you know, muscles the size of, like, his head to fight with. And there's a woman who I think turns into a cheetah, or she summons a cheetah, or something with a cheetah.
Okay, a cat lady. Okay, good.
And robot guy.
Robot guy, I like
that. I think he was the guy that I played with in the original. And then, other than that, I have no idea who else is in that game. But I know they only release it with 4 or 5 characters at launch, and then they're going to add more in as time goes on. That's going to be future DLC or part of, like, your $60 season pass.
Right. Hey, here's half a game. You can have the rest later.
I think it's more like a quarter or like a 16th.
Did you by any chance play a little indie release called Skull Girls?
I tried the free weekend that was on Steam, I think, 2 weeks ago.
Oh, right, on the PC, that's right. Yeah.
It was pretty interesting. The art style was really well done. I'm used to, you know, like, the more realistic, very, like, detailed characters, you know, stuff you see in Street Fighter or any, like, those really complex ones, like Guilty Gear games. Mm-hmm. But the more, like, cartoon style was pretty well done.
Yeah, I really like their character design in that a lot. When I had to, for some awards I was doing last year, I was thinking about my favorite character design of the year, and I one of them, my main pick was just this weird little, she's like from the Steamboat Willie era of animation, a little orphan. She looks like a little orphan Annie, but she's this killer cybernetic robot chick, and her name is Peacock, and she smokes a cigar, and she just personified for me just the incredibly imaginative character design, and they had a lot of cool gameplay stuff in terms of using the fighting game mechanics to express these characters in Skullgirls. So my favorite character design last year was Peacock from Skullgirls, and I really love what those guys did. So I, you know, if they can do something like that with Killer Instinct, more power to them. I just know it's got to be difficult to, without some kind of license, create a fighting game community. So we'll see how Killer Instinct works out.
And I know Mortal Kombat, the expert fighting gamers, the ones who I was never really an expert fighting game guy. Mm-hmm. I played a little bit of Soul Calibur. I was okay at Smash Brothers, but then when I tried to play that like at competitive level, I was just horrifically killed in that game. Mm-hmm. But I know the hardcore guys, they've been debating about Injustice. I know they had sort of similar discussion with Mortal Kombat 9, whether or not that was going to be a fighting game community standard, like Street Fighter, Guilty Gear, probably a few other ones were.
That's got to be a tough row to hoe for fighting game developers, is do we make something that's accessible beyond the normal hardcore players who want something balanced for tournaments, or do we make something for guys like Tom Chick and I presume Josh Beiser, who would just want to faff around and you know, more casual players. And I know that's, you know, it's got to be a tough decision they make, because you can't really have it both ways. It's either like Capcom, for instance. I think the way they traditionally approach it is they make their Street Fighter games for the more technical fans, and then they make Marvel vs. Capcom for the guys like me who just want to watch a bunch of crazy, colorful things happen, mm-hmm. and who want, you know, licensed characters, who want Wolverine or whatever in the game. Yeah.
And I think another part of that is simply the fact that most fighting games don't actually teach you how to play.
Yeah.
Or play at a competitive level with, you know, zoning, punishing, and all that high-level stuff. Most of them, you know, the tutorial is, you know, press X to punch, press back to block, and that's pretty much the extent what they're going to teach you.
Or then you'll get some challenge mode where you've got to do crazy frame-canceling timing tricks or whatever mm-hmm. to get past a level, and I just find myself, you know, I'll bang my head against those maybe 7 or 8 times before I'm like, okay, forget this. This is just not for me. That's, by the way, one of the things that NetherRealms, I think, does very well is creating, they did it with the Mortal Kombat game, they did it with Injustice, creating a suite of challenges that aren't all about the technicalities of a fighting game. There's just crazy little, they're like mini games. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, bring Catwoman into a crazy mini game where she's chasing dogs away from a door or something. I mean, there's a character named Lobo who, I don't know who he is. He rides a motorcycle and he has guns, whatever. And some of his mini games, there's one where it's like you're playing Galaga and you're trying to capture space porpoises or something. And I have no idea what's going on there, but you have to respect that they're doing something so crazy and I don't understand it. And certainly nobody who is coming to this game looking for a technical tournament level fighting game is going to care about this. So I just love that there's that kind of frippery in Injustice. And it's all based around whatever fiction is behind this character who I don't know.
But for more or less what we know, that's probably some like deep, outstanding plot in the DC comic.
it's definitely probably a nod to the lore, I'm certain. Yeah.
Let's see. Next up, best driving game, Forza Motorsport 5.
All right.
And let's see. Runner-ups, F1 2013, Grid 2, Need for Speed Rivals. Driving games are another one that I just have not been able to get into. What about you?
Josh, I'm convinced that somewhere out there, there's a driving game for you. Driving games, there are lots of different kinds of driving games, and I think you just have to find the right one. Some of them ask you to care about, for instance, your lap time. You know, you have to care so much about shaving a few seconds off of this course that you practice a particular turn. You know, that's one kind of driving game. Some of them are more into the car collecting. And a game like Forza, by the way, can appeal to that driving game where you shave a few seconds off a lap and the car collecting. But then there are games, you know, Rivals is just, hey, just bang into other cars. And I don't think Rivals is very good. But there's a Need for Speed Most Wanted that was out last year, which is much more akin to an open world game like a Grand Theft Auto. I still think one of the best driving games of any subgenre, subtype, is Rockstar's Midnight Club Los Angeles. That game looks fantastic. They did amazing stuff with the car progression to give it this RPG flavor. The sense of place, which Rockstar is so good at, is so keenly felt there. They did a South Central add-on eventually, but it's just Los Angeles. It's a little bit of the Valley. You know, the kind of world building you can see in GTA 5. They were doing that in Midnight Club Los Angeles a few years prior. And even something that so few driving games get right, the sense of moving around in traffic. That's such a difficult thing to get right, because you can't really put a bunch of cars, you can't put real traffic in a game, because that would just, that would take up so much computational power. So yeah. Various games cheat it in various ways. But I think no game has done traffic like Midnight Club Los Angeles. So Josh, it's just a matter of we haven't found the right one for you yet.
I did try Midnight Club, I think the first one, or maybe part of the second one, like, a very long time ago. Mm-hmm. I did like the Burnout series, but that was mainly due to, like, the crash mode, when you had to, like, rack up as many points as possible.
Yep, yep. Well, they kind of abandoned that concept, and it became more of a Need for Speed-style game over the years, but, yeah.
There was this one test drive, something. It was, like, they gave you, like, the Island Hawaii to drive around in, or something
yep,
like that.
Yep, and then Test Drive Unlimited. Test Drive Unlimited 2 featured it must have been a real island. It's like someplace off the Iberian Peninsula, I think. And then it also had a Hawaiian island. And the last Forza, by the way, were also open world games where you just drive around and you do tracks. And Test Drive Unlimited had this idea. They wanted it to be very social, and you would have a car club, and your club would challenge other car clubs. And it never really took off because they had a lot of technical issues. But yeah, that was a good game as well. So you played a little of that. That kind of worked for you?
It did a little bit. This was before I actually got an Xbox 360, so I was only able to try out at the GameStop near me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting how the racing genre has sort of adopted open world mechanics to it. But then there's some like Gran Turismo that still is, you're basically locked into these different courses.
Yeah, Gran Turismo is very much a traditionalist. I can't see them. It was kind of bold when Forza became an open world game. I don't think that Forza 5 is doing that. Maybe it is. I actually know very little about the latest Forza. But I can't see Gran Turismo doing anything that bold.
Yeah, I think I bought either 4 or 5, the PS3. No, it was the PS2 one. It was on sale one time, and I tried that, and it just didn't do a thing for me. Like, I really don't have a car knowledge or car sense when it comes to, you know, what's better, Ford or Toyota or whatever. And they were asking me to, like, look at all these things, and it just overwhelmed me in a few minutes.
You're not a gearhead, Josh.
No, I am not. I'm a dreamer, I think.
I'm sure there's a car in there for you. What would a dreamer drive, Josh? What car do you drive in real life?
I don't drive because of problems with my right leg, so I really haven't driven. I got my driver's license, but I just can't really drive a car anymore, at least a normal car.
What, did you have like a first car growing up when you were a kid that you got? Do you remember what that would be?
No, not
Wait,
really.
Where do you live that you don't have a car? Do you have like public transportation? Are you in one of those sort of socialist cities?
No, I live in Cherry Hill in New Jersey.
Oh, yeah, the East Coast is that place is lousy with public transportation, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. When I was going to college, I always commuted back through bus and our tram system, the speed line.
You can't get away with that in Los Angeles. You have to have a car. So if you came out here, you'd have to suck it up and somehow drive a car. So I asked simply because I drive a terribly nerdy, undramatic car, and I hear that you get this car in Gran Turismo 6, and it's a Honda Fit, which is just, it's kind of a soccer mom car. Actually, that might even be too grandiose a description. I'm not sure what you call it. It's just a little boring, practical car. And it's what you start with in Gran Turismo 6, I've been told. Or at least it's an option. So that makes me want to get Gran Turismo 6. I can drive my real world car.
Like, I saw on the review, they have, like, these, like, mini game challenges where you're, like, go-karting around or you're driving on the moon.
Mm.
And I don't know, like, how that fits with collecting all these cars, but, you know, more power to them.
Well, it's not very realistic, is it?
Next up, best DLC, and the winner was Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon, with runner-ups of the Borderlands 2, the Tiny Tina DLC. They had to be really specific with that, I guess.
How was Blood Dragon DLC? Because that was a standalone product.
Yeah.
What's going on over there at VGX? I'm calling shenanigans.
I don't know. I'm not even sure like how they actually pick any of these winners other than, you know, names in a hat. Like,
yeah, are there judges there that we can implicate? What's the methodology? Someone get Jeff Keighley on the line.
Or Jeff Knightley.
or Keira Knightley. I'll talk to her as well.
That would be pretty good. And I don't know if like Joel McHale actually did any judge. I think they just said he was there talking drunker most of the time.
Talking drunker? What did you say?
He was just like talking like he wasn't really making much sense. I think he like slurred his lines a few times.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, he's a big Netflix TV star. He's probably got other places to be. And yeah. Didn't he? Doesn't he do like? Hasn't he done Ubisoft press conferences at E3? Is that the guy I'm thinking of?
I know Aisha Tyler. She did the Ubisoft.
Right. But before her, he's like a kind of a smarmy, just sort of generic looking stand-up comic type guy, right?
I think he's done.
Okay, but I think he's done video game coverage before.
Possibly.
Okay.
Let's see, Borderlands 2, they had a lot of DLC this year, and they're still doing it now. They've been doing the seasonal stuff. Borderlands 2, that was interesting, because I know a lot of people complain about the season pass, how it didn't include everything that was released, and that they're still releasing stuff, but there hasn't been a second season pass.
Yep, well, you know, season pass only lasts one season. Can't say they didn't warn you.
Yep. See, the Dishonored Knife of Dunwall, that was a runner-up as well. Mm-hmm. I tried Dishonored, and it didn't click for me, but I only really played for like an hour or two, like up to like the second or part of the second mission. But I heard good things about it. Did you play that one?
I did. I liked some of it. What famous voice actor was in, here's a quiz for you, Josh, was in Dishonored?
I have no idea. I didn't play long enough to look at the names.
Chloe Moritz Grace was one of the. She was the little girl, I think.
Usually, I've gotten good at picking up voice actors. I can pretty much like pick up like Jennifer Hale, and this is from watching all like the anime series growing up in the 90s and 2000s. I still watch most anime series, so they pretty much have like the same stable of voice actors. So once you pick up their voice one time, you can pretty much hear it in almost like anything else.
Like Ellen Page in Last of Us. But it wasn't. I tricked you. She was in Beyond Two Souls.
Damn. But they both, like, one feature actually Ellen Page face model, and the other one feature, like, Ellen Page reimagined, right?
Right.
Which, I guess that's something. I guess movie David Cage's dream was to have, very realistic-looking William Dafoe as well. That was another high mark of that game.
Well, yeah, they put a bunch of dots on their face, and they have them act with each other, and that's for the game.
All right. Oh, if you love the best DLC category, you're going to love this one. Next one, best Xbox game. And the winner was Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons. That was actually released for the Xbox. I thought that was an indie game.
Wow. Okay. Good for them. So that was better than like any sort of Halo or Gears of War. There's a Gears of War this year, so that was better than Gears of War. Good.
And apparently it was better than Bioshock Infinite and Grand Theft Auto 5 and Tomb Raider.
Well, are those Xbox? Like, is the idea that it's something exclusive to the Xbox? I don't understand their rules.
Yeah. We got to get Keira Knightley on the phone for this.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. Best PlayStation game, Last of Us. And runner-up, Grand Theft Auto 5, Tomb Raider, and Rayman Legends. I don't know why Rayman Legends was just confined to PlayStation.
That game was actually developed for the Wii U.
Yeah. And it was released on the PC as well. I haven't played the new one yet. I played the one before that, Origins. Very well done platformer.
Absolutely.
I think that was like the first time in a while that a platformer just really got difficult at the end. I was doing like the super hard, final level stuff, and I think I was actually playing to like 5 in the morning because I didn't want to start that level back at 0 again. So I just said, I'm just going to stay up. Let me just finish this whole thing. I got to barely at 6 o'clock in the morning after finishing that one level up.
I understand. You get in the groove and you can't just quit.
Yep. All right, best Nintendo game, Super Mario 3D World. Runner-ups were Pikmin 3, Rayman Legends again, and The Wonderful 101. And I think they actually had Reggie from Nintendo on the VGX show. I think that was one of the clips they said was pretty horrible, so I don't remember what they actually did with it.
He can hold his own, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nintendo, we've been talking about this on the cast a few times. It's been not exactly a good time for Nintendo this past year. Yeah, they just haven't been really doing much. And I think the Wii U has been still like third. I don't know if they've even like broke 100,000 units sold of it yet. But are you still there, Tom?
Yeah.
Didn't you play the Wonderful 101, or I think that was reviewed on 4-3?
Yes, Wonderful 101 I quite like. It's one of those Nintendo sleepers. I'm not entirely sure who it's for. It has a kind of a candy-colored kitty vibe to it, but it's serious gameplay. I think anyone who enjoyed Bayonetta would also enjoy some of the cool things they do with that. But yeah, I quite like it. I don't know a lot of business talk, but I think Nintendo they're playing kind of by different rules, it seems to me, than Microsoft and Sony. So I don't know if they're hurting or not, but I do see a lot of creative. It seems like they're still taking creative chances. I know that the latest Zelda game, Link to the Past for the 3DS, that they mixed up the approach there quite a bit. I've heard a lot of great things about Super Mario 3D World, and I'll be starting a series on that at 2:45 as an avowed Mario hater. And one of my problems with it is that I really, really like the Rayman game, for instance. I love a game called Tearaway from Media Molecule that I just played. So I think there's some really cool, exciting things happening with platformers, and I consistently see that Nintendo just doesn't recognize them and does their own thing. And I don't know if that's the case with Super Mario 3D World or not, but I'll be exploring that with another writer, actually starting probably by the time this podcast is posted.
Cool. Yeah, Mario, the recent 3D Mario games have been pretty, I wouldn't, they've been somewhat standard in some aspects. They, of course, feature the same stories, but Nintendo has gotten almost like a really good blueprint down for designing their levels so that if you're completely new to the games, you can play it one way. If, you know, you've mastered every Mario jump there is, you can get through the level a different way. But one of the problems that I think they have is that if you're like an expert or someone, if you play Rayman Legends or any of those other platforms, you're pretty much already well versed in it, but then you're still forced to spend the first quarter of the game bored out of your mind doing basic platform until you get to like their post game, now we're finally going to open the game up type content.
Yeah, yeah. There's several different levels you can play those at, but yeah. So, do you even have a Wii U, Josh?
No, I do not. It's on the list, hopefully, at some point to grab.
In the discussion of, I guess, whether you want to call them action-adventure games or open-world games, in the discussion of the best of those out this year, I think that LEGO City Undercover, which is exclusive to the Wii U, absolutely belongs in that conversation.
Really? Yeah, I know the LEGO games have gotten a lot of popularity over the years, LEGO Star Wars and all that, but I really haven't played a lot of them. So is Traveler's Tale still doing the LEGO series, or have they moved on?
No, they've got a good thing going, and they're continuing to go with it. They just did a Marvel Superheroes-themed one. But LEGO City Undercover came from a separate studio that used to do some of the handheld ports of the LEGO games, and they just turned it over to these guys and said, why don't you do your own? And it showed, I mean, there's a lot of new creative energy in LEGO City Undercover that you don't see in some of the stuff that Traveler's Tales core studio has been doing. So yeah, it's one of the year's best games, it's one of the year's best open world games, and it's certainly one of the best LEGO games that I've ever played.
Interesting. All right. So we've been talking about the video game award show for last 50 minutes. We only discuss each one, but we'll just finish up the list of the rest of the awards. So best PC game, Gone Home got that again. Best handheld game was the Legend of Zelda game we just talked about, Tom. Best casual game was Animal Crossing New Leaf. Best voice actor, apparently Troy Baker not only won for it, but he was also the runner-up as Booker DeWitt.
He beat himself.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Best voice actress, Ashley Johnson as Ellie. The soundtrack was Grand Theft Auto 5. Best song in the game, I have no idea how that is a category. Will the Circle Be Unbroken? The song from Bioshock Infinite. And, oh wait, you were talking about the judging. According to, they have the VGX Council, who counts back, my tongue is drawing on myself. They are the ones who apparently judged all the games. I have no idea who this mysterious group is.
Shadowy figures from behind the scenes pulling the strings. I see what's going on.
Yeah. And, but they did have three viewer-voted awards. Most anticipated game was Titanfall. Character of the Year was the twins from Bioshock Infinite, who I'm not pronouncing that first name.
Lucretia?
They may have spelled it wrong on the list. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't remember. Okay.
And best mobile game was Plants vs. Zombies 2. So, apparently, as we'll talk about near the end of the cast, there was no strategy games on this list.
Well, those guys don't play strategies.
Yeah. And, like I said, I'm so surprised Gone Home was mentioned on Spike, but then again, they did give last year's best game to The Walking Dead. So, I guess there's some positive momentum there. I guess last thing to say about the VGX show was, really, I'm still waiting for like an actual, I guess, more formal or more interesting award show for the video game industry. At least something, I wouldn't say like artsy, but something a little bit more professional. What do you think, Tom?
It's just another symbol of how, in a way, we're still very young. And part of it is there are no, the Academy Awards and the Golden Globes all come from these established bodies, whether it's the Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences or the Foreign Press Association. And I don't know that we really have those kind of bodies around video gaming yet. So we're stuck with Yahoo's like Spike TV. Of course, different publications all do their own year-end lists. In movies, there are critics circles, for instance, that will put together their year-end lists. But I'm for the most part, I'm okay with just having articulate writers write about their own picks. You know, I don't, the Video Game Awards is not for me. You know, bless their hearts for whatever they're doing. And I'm just content to hear from different, unique, distinctive voices, rather than whoever these judges are, who are doing things to help sell Doritos and Mountain Dew. Yeah.
The only, I think, award show that I guess is somewhat considered high class for the video game industry, I guess, is like the DICE award shows, like the one that's usually held at GDC.
Right, right. Yeah, I guess that is the respectable counterpart, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that's my news. So what do you have to talk about?
My news of the week is I don't know why anyone would do this, but a lot of people love jumping into early access games, basically banging on alphas. My own feeling is, there are so many finished games out there to be played. Why do you want to play one that's not done? But I think a lot of it is excitement. So there's a very ambitious title that its first stage of beta has been released, early access on Steam. You can now jump into Starbound. And this is an offshoot from Terraria, which was a 2D procedurally generated kind of survival Minecraft style game. And something happened with the developers of Terraria. They stopped development for a while. It was later picked up. But some of them went on to create a new studio called Chucklefish. And Chucklefish's first game is Starbound, which is in the Terraria mold. But the idea is that instead of one world with different biomes, you have different worlds, each its unique biome. And there's a kind of a meta layer with a spaceship where you move around to the different worlds. So if you are so inclined to play an early build of something, Starbound is now available.
Yeah, and as a bit of warning for people who are interested, I believe they're releasing a patch either today or tomorrow, or by the time this cast is actually aired, last, you know, Monday or Tuesday, that is wiping all the characters.
Which, again, why would you subject yourself to that?
Yeah, and I have a post that I'm writing about that soon for the site, that it's sort of like I'm taking, you know, the devil's advocate approach to this whole early access thing, and the problem for me is that I'm so tempted to play these games in Alpha 1 or Beta 0.5 that I'm going to sour myself when the game actually comes out. I'll be too tired to really play the game when it's new or when it's released, and I'm still hung up on the fact that my base couldn't work properly in Space or in Planetary Annihilation that they still haven't gone most of the units in, and I just find that it's just so much of a temptation that I have to not look at these games on my Steam list. I pretend they're not there.
Well, it really is I think just a lot of it is people who are excited, who it's kind of like watching a movie trailer in a way. So what if it's not complete? You're getting the highlights. And for me, those highlights kind of spoil it. I would rather those highlights be a part of the actual experience rather than lifted wholesale and used to presented early to me before the game is done, before the finished movie's in front of me. So I'm super looking forward to Starbound. I really liked a lot of things about Terraria, and I like the direction they're taking Starbound, but I'll wait until it's done. I'm patient.
Yeah. So. And that's pretty much why, like, about spoiling, why I just don't see the need to, when you, like, look at the Kickstarters, and they always have, you know, a very expensive goal being, you know, buy into the alpha, buy into the beta, play the game, you know, 8 months before it's released. I'm just sitting there going, why would I want to do that? Why would I want to play the game at its most buggiest, unfinished state when I could, you know, let my imagination run wild and wait for the game to actually come out and experience it at its best quality?
Or, you know, yeah, spend your time before playing games that are similar, that are finished, that are complete, you know. For instance, why is anybody who's playing the early build of Starbound, why aren't they instead playing Don't Starve or Terraria? You know, why aren't they playing Terraria? Maybe there are some people who've completely plumbed all of these other great survival games, but I just sort of feel like, you know, there are finished games out there. Why aren't you playing those?
And then there's, of course, the argument that a lot of people are saying that most games released these days aren't released in a finished state, that they're going to keep getting built on top of and more content's being added.
Yes, you're encouraging bad practice. practices. You people buy playing Starbound now. Exactly. That's another way to put it. Yeah.
And I know people have been complaining about Payday 2, which we talked about on one of the quarter.
Oh, yeah. Podcasts. What's going on? What are they complaining about that for? What's the latest with Payday 2? I haven't touched base with that in a while.
Oh, they've been releasing several patches. They've done a Halloween theme update where you had 1 week to unlock, I think, 8 exclusive masks. They had, you know, super rare materials and decals. They released the first DLC, the one that anyone who pre-ordered the game got for free. And they just released a second DLC that apparently adds grenades.
Whoa, that's huge. How many times have I been playing, you know, Payday 1 or Payday 2 and thought, man, I wish I had a grenade? That's, I don't know how I feel about that, Josh.
Yeah, and a lot of people aren't too happy by the fact that it's $4 or $5 for that DLC. Comes with, you get the grenade unlocked, you get the ability to unlock parts that allow you to turn your weapons into either single shot or full auto variants. But there's no new heists to it. Oh, and of course, new masks and decals. So a lot of people complain, you know, why are you charging me $5 for grenades?
Right.
And they still haven't added in cloakers, the guys.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And there's still no safe house customization. And that was something that was promising to come, quote unquote, very soon, the game's release. So it's definitely a bit weird. And they also completely redid the weapon system. They removed all the bars that would tell, you know, this weapon, the bar was, you know, a little bit longer than this one. So it's therefore better doing damage. It's now all number based. So now you see, oh, my armor grants me 28 points of dodge, or this gun does 10 points of stability, or something like that.
Do you not like that? Like, is that a cause for complaint?
Not really. I think that was a pretty good one, but they have been talking about a completely redoing the skill trees. There's been buzz that they're going to be releasing that as the next big update to the game, mm-hmm. that they're going to redo all the skill trees.
That'll make people angry.
Yeah, and they're going to make it, I think, they're making it a lot harder to go down multiple trees. The rumor is they're making it so the first tree, you can buy that, you know, pretty quickly and get that level one, you're done. But then for each subsequent tree, you need to add more points just to get in the door. Mm-hmm. So to get your second tree, you need to put 5 points in to get the first skill unlock. And then if you want to do a third tree, I think it's like 10 or 15 skill points. Mm-hmm. And the game still has that hard limit of level 100. So you are pretty much locked, and even at level 100, it still is pretty hard to get everything that you want. I guess the only real benefit to that is if they're completely redoing the skills, hopefully they'll make the skills a lot more useful, because there are a lot of skills spread across that are either so vital that you need to take it, or you can just forget about it. I think the example that I like is, like, the ghosts. You can get skill points for, you know, increased damage for your silenced weapons, but either you're going to play the game silent, so you're going to just be meleeing everyone, or you're going to be loud, so it's sort of like not really necessary.
Frankly, Josh, you're a beast at that game. I can't imagine that whatever they do is going to affect you basically just running roughshod over any particular heist.
They did change the dodge mechanic. There's this brief period where dodge was superior to armor, so I was just running around in, like, the basic suit and surviving. And I had people yelling at me going, why the hell are you wearing a suit? You're going to get us all killed. And that guy is always the one who goes down 3 or 4 times during the heist, and I'm just perfectly fine.
Uh-huh.
Although I will say the best skill that I got was the Mastermind, their ultimate one, their like top 3 super skills, is you get the ability to shout and get someone up just by yelling at. So when you, instead of having to run and hold down the key to lift them up, you just hit the screen key and the guy just pops up on their own.
You mean trying to resurrect someone, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I like that. As a medic who just sort of shouts at you to get up and walk it off.
Yeah, and it's just funny, too. And I saw that when I was doing the Halloween event, but I finally got it afterwards. And it is pretty much a life-saving event, because you don't have to be out of cover to get them up. You just have to stand far enough back and yell at them.
You know who else can do that, Josh?
Who?
The Siren in Borderlands 2. True story.
They did that with her, right? She can be played either as like a elemental doing more type damage, or she's more like support or healing character.
Yep. And I remember getting at some point the ability to just not have to run up to someone to resurrect them. Just do it from a distance. She doesn't shout though. She's way too ladylike for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. going back to Starbound, I've been hearing a lot of people talk about that on my circles and on Quarter 3 as well. It does look like an interesting game. I will say that when I tried Terraria, it didn't really hook me. But then again, I wasn't really that amazed with Minecraft. I love the technology of the game, but I've never been a guy who likes just pure sandbox experiences. I like to have some kind of goal, some type of, you know, carrot at the end of the stick to work
with. Have you played Don't Starve?
Yes, I have.
Because I feel what Don't Starve, and I want to hear about your thoughts on it, but what Don't Starve did for me that the Terrarias and the Minecrafts and even the Starbounds, I assume, don't really do, is it has this urgency in that it has permadeath. So you're just trying to stay alive as long as you can. And if you die, that's it. You get to start over. Terraria, and I guess you could play those. I seem to recall in Terraria, you just play, and if you die, you respawn back at your house. And certainly Minecraft is sandboxy to a fault. But that's what it really took for me to get into games like Terraria, is Don't Starve's sense of urgency, the permadeath. So did Don't Starve at all work for you better than Terraria or Minecraft?
It did. The only problem that I had with Don't Starve was it kind of got to the point where once you figure out the necessities of the game, you can pretty much solve the game every way that time. Like, there wasn't any need for me. Like, once I got to the point that I could survive winter, I could, like, the basic element of the game just sort of died out. They did have, like, the missions, or they had, like, a story mode where you go to these theme worlds.
Oh, right, yeah.
I was not able to get through that, actually. I got as far as, I was able to get to, like, one of, like, the world's, like, never-ending winter, and I just could not get through. I always got, like, three-fourths of the way done, and I always freeze to death. What they've been doing with Don't Starve since release, they've added in a new biome back in the form of caves. So you can now go underground, there's mm-hmm. rare materials and stuff like that, and it's interesting, but there still really isn't any, like, quote-unquote, like, endgame, or something for you to work towards as opposed to just surviving. But as you said, that urgency is definitely unique to the game. Yeah. I think it does add a lot to it.
And I think it's something, too, that I know there's another one came out called Darkout that they added kind of a story mode in that one of the things you want to look for are these story-based audio logs. I think there's 20 of them. So the idea is you play until you get all 20 of them, and you have then discovered what really happened or something like that. And it reminds me of a game, too, that a friend of ours did, Josh, Chris Park, his Valley Without Wind.
Yeah.
Again, a big survival-oriented kind of crafty thing. It didn't have permadeath, though. But they had all these story logs that you would also find, and I only found, I think, two of those in the hours I played at that. But that's another approach, is that some of these developers, like with Darkout and Valley Without Wind, they'll hide the, you know, there's a finite number of a particular collectible that has some narrative purpose. So I kind of appreciate that as well.
Yeah.
The character unlocks in Don't Starve were a huge pull for me as well. Like, I want to unlock this character and see what he or she does, and I want to see how much that will help me in the early stages of survival. And I think Starbound does something similar with player races. As you pick a race, and each race has some unique ability. But again, I won't know until it's done and it's out, and then I'll play it.
And I don't think they've actually announced, like, an actual release date yet.
It's done.
Okay. And I know a lot of these early access games are trying to go for monthly updates, you know, a way to keep things going. I know Prison Architect does it, Double Fine doing it with Space. And I think that is a good move to sort of keep the game, I guess, keep awareness of the game. But again, it's sort of like the same type problem that, you know, your game may be excited about something that's still not even done yet, or, you know, something that's going to be introduced in Alpha 10 that may be ready to go by Alpha 12 or 13.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But with Move On, then, I guess we can talk a little bit about some of the games we've been playing. So, since I went first with the news, Tom, what game have you been playing?
My current obsession is raising my score in State of Decay, speaking of urgency. State of Decay, I know you mentioned you're playing a little bit. I want to talk about, you said it wasn't really working for you. State of Decay is kind of two games, not really, but there's the core game, which has a story beat in it and has a definite end. I was a little surprised to get to a point in State of Decay where it's over. You've finished the game. You know, it's one of these survival open world kind of games, and it definitely ends. And you can't go back and level up your survivors or look for more stuff. It's over. If you want to play more, you start over. So one of the things that they just made available about, I think it came out a couple of weeks ago, is some DLC called Breakdown, which creates an endless survival mode. And it also has scoring associated with it. And the idea, they only have the one map. It's Trumbull Valley. It has kind of three little city town areas in it, and some farmlands in the middle. You play on the map until you find an RV, and you repair the RV. And then whenever you're ready, you put all of the loot that you found and some of your resources, and you pick five of your survivors, and you carry them on to a new map, which is physically it's the same map, but it's restocked, and it's now harder. And you keep iterating it that way. You play through the map, you carry it onto the new map, and each time you play, you're earning a score. And the score is boosted by the difficulty level that you've reached. So right now, I think I'm on the fourth map, and I'm just sort of biding my time, doing quests, earning points. I'm trying to see how high I can get my score before I go on to the next map, and basically restock it and reset my characters. Sorry, go ahead.
When you say that it gets harder with each difficulty level, how do they make things like harder for players?
So they're not super explicit about this. I've talked to the developers somewhat, and I think they, it's not that they don't want you to know, but they like kind of being vague about things that I wish they wouldn't be vague about. But what you can clearly tell is there are fewer resources. Zombies will come out in hordes, which are really about a dozen of them. And these spawn from infestations. And an infestation is kind of a mission. You can go clear it out. It can be difficult because there are some of the unique zombies in there. And you can have these cascading failures where you think you're fighting a couple of them, and then a couple more come from the side, and then you've alerted a horde, and then there's a screamer. So these infestations pop up, and they spawn hordes. They'll pop up more readily on the higher difficulty levels. They even monkey with some of the basic mechanics. One of the changes in the higher difficulty level, when you're playing, you get used to looking at the minimap to see when a zombie is coming up behind you. They show up as little dots. One of the things that happens as you're going up to the harder difficulty levels, the zombies don't show up on the minimap. And that's huge. And ideally, the idea is that the score multiplier that you get makes it worth playing on the harder difficulty level. So you can play either State of Decay as a story-based game, the once and done, or you can get the DLC, and there are none of the story beats in there. It's just a scoring game. And that's what I've been playing lately. Now you mentioned, so I presume, Josh, did you just sort of dink around with the basic State of Decay and it wasn't working for you?
Yeah, I have not bought the DLC. I've mainly been playing the original form of it. And my problems, I guess, first from a technical layer, the game is very rough. I think you mentioned this on your review, and there definitely are a lot of bugs in the game. I had characters, you know, sort of like combined into each other, like two models got stuck. I had issues where, like, it was really hard to see where I was going. Like, dark in that game was just really dark. I don't know, it may have just my monitor need to raise the gamma up on that. But I had a hard time seeing, even with the flashlight on. Mm-hmm. And the big technical issue for me, actually this may be more gameplay related, is the fact that the game tracks things, it's sort of quasi-real time. In the sense that you can probably explain this better than I can, but when you log out and when you log back in, certain elements of the game sort of get certain resources are consumed, like if you're gone for a day or when you log in and out. And you mentioned this on your review of Breakdown, that expert players can sort of cheat the system by just playing for really long periods of time and not having that impact their gameplay.
Yeah. So first of all, the dark thing I think is intentional, and I love that they do that. I mean, dark, most games represent dark as just blue. Everything you can still see as much. But there are definitely issues in State of Decay where you don't want to go into that barn at night because it's hard to see. And where you're aiming your flashlight is important. And I love that they do that. But it's distinct from other video games, and I can see how it would be annoying. But yeah, that real-time thing is weird. So what happens is, when you're playing, there's a day-night cycle. You know, it's day, it's night, it's day, it's night. And that doesn't do anything in terms of your survivors, because you play as multiple characters. You're not just one dude. You've got your survivors. You can pretty much play any one of them at any given time. They skill up differently. You equip them differently. And then while you're off doing your own thing as the playable survivor, the other guys are doing things as well. So there's a day-night cycle. One of the things you have to be aware of is how much food, medicine, ammo, fuel, and building materials are consumed every, quote, day. But this supply consumption isn't the game's day-night cycle. It's the real-world day-night cycle. So if I sit down and I play for 6 hours, and there have been in those 6 hours, 3 day-night cycles, I think that's how it works, an hour of day, an hour of night. My survivors never slept during that time. They didn't eat. They didn't use any of the medicine. That only happens when I'm logged off at midnight. If I'm playing through midnight, nothing happens. It waits until I log off, and then it tallies that midnight accounting against me. So what this means for some people, and if I log off for a long time, my survivors will go off and they'll do missions to bring me supplies, but then they'll also use the supplies. Sometimes they can go off and do missions, and a die roll can mean, oh, they needed to be rescued, and you weren't there to rescue them, so they're dead. So for some people, this means, hey, if I'm not playing, I'm being penalized. And that's kind of true. Your supplies are being used. The income of supplies might not match up. Morale might drop because you're not there to do missions. And one of the things that Undead Labs, the developer, did in response to people complaining about this is they minimized the impact of not playing over successive days. So that if I log off for one day and I come back, yeah, some of my supplies will be used. My morale might be dropped. I might have to go rescue a new survivor. That's one thing. If I log off for a week, you know, they're not going to stack up 7 days of penalties against me. I think what they do is the first day applies, and then the second day is 50%, and the third day is a quarter, something like that. That there's this sort of sense of, if you want to put the game down for a long time, they're not going to penalize you for it. But for me, the bigger issue is that if I sit down and I play for 6 hours and those day-night cycles happen, and if I can play through an entire map in that time, I never had to get food for my survivors. They never need food except at midnight when you're logged off. So if I'm playing this as a scoring game, which is what I'm doing now and how I'm really enjoying Breakdown, I can totally game it by just making a point not to log off at midnight. And my survivors don't need food. I don't need to build a place for them to sleep, which is a huge deal because there's base building there and you only have so many slots in each base. So you have to decide, you know, this slot is my workshop. This one, of course, is my medical bay. I need that. This slot, I'm going to use for a library. This slot, I'm going to use for a kitchen for food. Oh, but guess what? I don't need food if I'm not going to be playing, you know, if I'm not going to leave the game alone overnight. And I don't need bunks if I'm not going to be there then. So, that weird day-night cycle in the game being divorced from the cycle where they actually advance the simulation and use supplies, it's a weird design decision.
And the other problem for me is I felt they could have done a better job in explaining all this to a new player. When you first start playing, you're given, like, the quote-unquote tutorial in, like, the first, like, ranger station, like, the northernmost part of the map.
Uh-huh.
And then you're taken to the town, and then they sort of just dump the whole thing on, building the outpost house, taking outposts, scavenging for resources. And it definitely was a bit of an overwhelming moment, because I had no idea if I was doing this right, or, you know, should I be going for food? Should I be focusing on medicine? And as you just said, if you basically game the system and play for a very long time, you don't need to worry too much about food or sleep.
Right.
And that's more of a way to game it, and I bet that expert players, the ones who are going for the really high scores, are probably doing just that.
Their dirty little secret, Josh, about the base game, the story beats, it's really pretty forgiving. And I think one of the complaints that one of the impetuses behind the Breakdown DLC was complaints that people were lodging about, hey, this is too easy. You know, I really want this to be more challenging, because people were playing through it, getting to the end and thinking, wow, that was awesome, let me go again, and discovering that there wasn't a lot of challenge there. So I think that's the point of Breakdown, is to add challenge. But what that means is, if you're just playing the base game, you're right, they kind of do. It feels like they're throwing you into the deep end, and there's constantly, you know, the girl, Lily Ritter, who's your radio operator, she's constantly telling you things about, hey, there's survivors over there that need your help. Whoa, one of our buddies is in a jam. Hey, here's this thing you can go check out. Whoa, here's this story mission. And you feel like you've got, you know, 7 things to do and only time to do 6 of them. But for the most part, it's a pretty forgiving game. And you end up, as you level up some of your characters, you end up climbing this power curve, and there's just not a lot of challenges you're going on. Except for the end, by the way. I don't want to spoil it, but oh, it gets really brutal at the end. The end of the story is, it's kind of mean, actually. And there's also some kind of crucial things, like, about the character skills that are kind of poorly explained. I think a lot of people who play the base game will have this weird eureka moment where they accidentally discover these unique skills that characters can learn, because they don't introduce those very well. And even then, they don't really explain how you're supposed to choose your skill. You can think that you're playing a character who has some special skill and it doesn't seem to be working. And if you look closer, you'll realize, oh, I didn't follow this weird three-step process to actually pick my skill. And they put that in there because they don't want you to accidentally pick the wrong skill. A lot of what this is, Josh, is the developer Undead Labs. This is their first game. They're really tiny for a studio doing a big open world game. I think they were also caught a little unawares by the success of this.
It's true. It was released originally on the Xbox. I know that's where a lot of people were playing it. I know quite a few people were saying, you know, it looks good, but I'm just going to wait for it to be on the PC.
Yeah. And they're using, do you know what engine this is, by the way? I find this incredibly amusing. This, Josh, is the Crytek engine.
Really?
So the same graphics engine that brought you Crysis is bringing you slightly awkward. But I have to say, though, I you know, there are technical issues with it, and some of the frame rate stuff I know people complain about on the 360. For me, I think it's a gorgeous game because of the artwork, because of how evocative it is. Going out in those fields, there's a for folks who like The Walking Dead, I think this game is such a godsend in that it presents the mythology of the zombie apocalypse as a story about survivors interacting with each other. And any good monster movie is not about the monsters. It's about the victims of the monsters. It's about the people. So if you look at Night of the Living Dead, the zombies are just kind of – Night of the Living Dead is a parlor room drama about people in a highly compressed crisis situation dealing with each other. And that, to me, is the kernel of zombie apocalypse mythology, is it should be about the survivors. And that's one of the things that Walking Dead, for better or worse, really does. Some people complain, ah, it's a soap opera. But it gets some of the stuff right. So one of the things I love about State of Decay is that, unlike Dead Rising or Dead Island or a lot of otherwise very good zombie games, it understands that the survivor should be the focus, that it should be character driven, that the drama of survival is the main appeal, and the zombies are kind of an obstacle. They're almost incidental. They're this threat that's out there. So some of my favorite scenes from Walking Dead, which are just iconic to me, are even if I wasn't liking the show at the time, are shots of like zombies out in fields of grass. And State of Decay just has some incredibly beautiful moments like that, where you're just driving out to a farmhouse to investigate some other survivors that are out there, and you just look out the side of your car window, and there's just these zombies just sort of walking around in the fields of wheat out there. And it's just incredibly beautiful in a way that in the way that Walking Dead sometimes is. And no other zombie game has really done that. So I'm sorry, you got me off on a tear. But yeah, even though the engine can be rough, the art assets and the way they use them are, to me, just incredibly precious and unique amongst zombie games.
And one thing that I do like about the concept of State of Decay is that you're not this, you know, one-man, super badass right. zombie killer. Yeah. You're generally, as you say, you're playing as multiple characters. So you're playing in community instead of, you know, like in Dead Rising or Left 4 Dead. You're not this lone man, one person. You can take on the entire zombie apocalypse on your own type deal. And one thing that I did notice in State of Decay is that when you're caught, like, in a group of zombies, you're pretty much screwed. You don't have the necessary abilities to pretty much one-man your way through like 16 or 20 zombies.
Right. Now, one of the things that they added, Josh, in the Breakdown DLC, which was apparently a hugely requested feature, you can walk up to another survivor, and for the cost of 100 influence, and influence is, it's a really smart system, by the way, it's their kind of equivalent for money. For 100 influence, you say to that survivor, hey, come with me. And you've got a wingman. Which I love, because you couldn't do that in the original game. There would be some times where you would do a mission with someone, but now you can play as a team.
And you say, like, there's special zombies, right? Like, you mentioned the screamer?
Yeah, so they have a screamer, which will do the scream and incapacitate you. These are kind of archetypes, I guess, in a way, aren't they, from Left 4 Dead? There's a screamer. There's, of course, the he doesn't puke, but he's a bloater, I think, and he blows up and creates this area of effect damage. And if you hit him with your car, by the way, the car fills up with his fumes.
Nice.
And you have to stop and pull over the car and let the car clear out before you can drive it again. So they have the screamer, the bloater, saving the worst for last. Oh, a feral zombie, which is kind of like the hoodie guy from Left 4 Dead, isn't it? And he's super fast and pretty resilient. But if you just sort of, like, you can run from him, and if you just pour enough damage on him, he's manageable. The one that I just cannot brook, I load these guys, and anytime someone wants to hunt them, I'm like, nope, you're on your own there. I'm not going to do that mission. There's something called a juggernaut, and a juggernaut is just a big old huge bag of hit points that rushes you, and he has his attack will basically lock you in this animation where, hey, I'm picking you up, and I'm doing a lot of damage, and if that damage depletes your health, I am now going to segue into an animation where you are literally ripped in half.
Nice.
And it's a really rude awakening when you realize that, hey, this was my best character, and you just ripped him in half. So those are the specials. And, of course, as in Breakdown, as you play the more difficult maps, not only will you find these guys more frequently, but you'll find them clumping together in groups to where you have to deal with two or three of them at a time. And I wouldn't begin to know. That's just... when I see that sort of thing, I'm just like, for the most part, okay, I don't need to deal with whatever is over there. I'm just going to try to go around these guys.
Yeah, and what's the alpha system? Because I saw that if you kill the zombies in an area, like you get like the uh-huh. like, circle around it.
So one of the smart things it does is there's a kind of a territorial control system. Now, you found a base, and that base basically means, okay, in this radius, there's going to be no, we're not going to spawn. Some will wander in, but we're not going to spawn any zombies. So you know you're safe. Those buildings then are safe to explore. It's safe to run around there. If you, for instance, put a sniper and give him extra ammo in your watchtower, it will extend that radius. It'll make it go out a little farther. And in the city areas, in the towns, this is hugely important because it expands the area where you can safely explore and not worry about getting jumped. An outpost lets you create that safe radius from any neutral building that you clear out. Furthermore, it puts a locker in that building. And a locker is a place where you can drop off and pick up equipment. And so it basically lets you, from a distance, forage stuff and then put it in that locker, and it'll kind of magically teleport back to your main base. And furthermore, the stuff that was at your main base will teleport out to you, and there you can pick it up. So the outpost is good for that. The outpost is also good, Josh, for an income of supplies. So if you make an outpost at, say, a grocery store, it will give you an income of food every nightly simulation cycle. And by nightly, I mean real-time midnight, not in-game. If you put an outpost in, say, a gun store, it'll give you extra ammo. If you put it at that veterinarian's place, there's a little veterinarian hospital, a pet hospital. If you put it there, it'll give you medicine. So the outpost system is part of territorial control, and it's part of your supply income.
And you can also upgrade, like, the different parts of each outpost. I think they said, like, certain buildings may have special upgrades unique to them.
Mm-hmm. With the buildings in your base, some of those will upgrade. I think the only thing you can do with outposts is use your fuel resource to plant mines around them. And what these will do, they'll just blow up zombie hordes. And you'll get influence from that. It's like doing a free mission. So that's what you can do at the outposts. But your main building, your main base, all the buildings there have various upgrades. I really like the base building stuff that they have there. Very much like a strategy game.
And yeah, so State of Decay is definitely one of those interesting games. I'll have to play a little bit more before I render like a final verdict. But as you said, it is a first-time game from a relatively new studio, and I do hope that this sort of gives them the motivation to make a sequel or expand on this one, because they do have a very unique concept, the game.
And to be fair to them, they're a first-time developer, but they have a lot of experience. It was founded by a fellow named, I believe it's Jeff Strain, and he comes from Blizzard. He was at ArenaNet working on Guild Wars for a long time, and their original intention was to do a zombie-themed MMO, and State of Decay was a kind of a stopgap, kind of a proof of concept thing that Microsoft asked them to do. They said, well, before we fund a full MMO, why don't you guys make an Xbox Live Arcade downloadable game? And it became a little bit bigger than they intended. And I think now, I don't know that they're talking about it, but I think this idea of an MMO, that's still very much in development there.
Yeah. I think I would like to see more of a single player type thing, or like a low number multiplayer type, because I'm just not sure if I would play an MMO of this, just because I'm not a huge MMO game myself.
Right. Well, I know that one of their biggest requests, and you, as you can imagine, is people saying, hey, why can't we play State of Decay co-op? You know, put multiplayer in here. And I do know, too, I can't imagine, it must be a huge engineering task to sort of to rework this as a multiplayer game. I can't imagine that's in store. But they have said that there is more DLC in store for State of Decay. Well, so there's something else going on with it.
All right. Moving on, my game that I've been playing for pretty much all weekend long is Marvel Puzzle Quest. And this is just another attempt at pretty much doing Marvel in a video game. And since, you know, the whole Avengers movie and the S.H.I.E.L.D. show on ABC, we've been seeing so many games pop up with a Marvel license. There was the Lego Marvel games. Tom, I know you were playing over, I think, the summer. There was a Marvel Diablo combination that came
out. Yes, Marvel Super Hero. Oh, geez, Pete, Josh, what's the name of that? Marvel Heroes. Wait, Hero? Yeah, Marvel Heroes? Is it that simple? But yeah, it's a free-to-play Diablo clone. And yours is like a Bejeweled clone, huh?
Yeah, it's based off of the Puzzle Quest games. I think they originally started as a Game Boy, I think it was on the DS or the Advance, and then it was also on the mobile devices. And I know they sort of had a little bit of success where they did like a sci-fi spoof or a sci-fi spiritual sequel. They did another sequel to it, and it's sort of like they combine like a Bejeweled or a Match 3 game with an RPG progression, RPG character building. And it sounds weird when you say it like that, but it sort of does work. Essentially, when you level up your characters, every time you match 3 or more gems, that basically counts as an attack on the enemy party. So when you level up a character, those basic match 3 or match 4 does more damage. But then each character has their own unique abilities that get activated if you save up enough gems, or if you collect 10 red gems, you can shoot a fireball or something like that. So the series sort of disappeared. I don't believe the same developers who did the previous Puzzle Quest games are doing the Marvel Puzzle Quest game. I know it's the same publisher. I think it's D3 Interactive or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So with the Puzzle Quest, it pretty much has a comic book story. So for people like probably me and Tom, probably won't be able to figure too much out in that regard. But what they did, which is very clever, and very insidious when it comes to the free-to-play aspect of it, is you make your party out of 3 heroes in your roster. And instead of just saying, you know, you have Iron Man, or you have Spider-Man, or whatever, your characters are basically comic book covers. They're basically represented by a cover of a comic book with that character. And so they have different, basically, versions of characters based on what comic they use. So they have Iron Man in his red armor. Then they have another Iron Man in black armor who has completely different skills and stats. And for someone like me who really never followed the comic books, I thought that was such a brilliant way of tying in the Marvel property into the game. And what they did, so in order to level up a character, and this is where the free-to-play monetization gets a little overboard in my opinion, to level up a character, you need to find a copy of that same comic cover. And that will basically let you raise the level of one of their available skills or unlock it. And then from there, after you do that, you can then spend in-game resource to level them up and give them more health and what. But as you can probably guess, if you don't find those comic book covers, you can't level those characters up. And if you can't level them up, they're basically useless when you're trying to fight, you know, a level 10 Wolverine or something like that.
So let me guess, either a lot of grinding or you can micro-buy the comics.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you can either, for like the tier 1 comics or like common comics, you can spend in-game resource. But the thing is, it's never a set buy. You can't say, I'm going to spend 200 points and unlock Iron Man. No, it's a random draw. So, of course, you know what that means. You're basically, you know, left to hoping and praying that I just spend 200 points on a character that I like, or I'm out 200 points. And then there's premium resource, which you can get by completing some missions, but it's mainly used, you spend real money on. And that is used for buying the higher-up comics. And then they also have a very annoying pay or wait mechanic. You see, your health is persistent across matches, and it heals and recovers normally through real time. So again, just like with Save the Decay, there's a real time element to it, but they're down to the actual minute. So if you're not playing, your characters will recover. But let's say you just had a horrible match where all three of your characters lost, so they all went down to zero. Depending upon what level they are, you could be spending an hour, 2 hours waiting for them to recover their health back to full before attempting that mission again. Or you use a consumable item that recovers them, which you can, once again, buy with real money. And it's sort of actually crosses that line a little bit in terms of, you know, demanding you to spend money. And it's a shame because I really love this idea that each one of these heroes has their own skills, and that gets tied into what gems you look for on the field. So, Iron Man, for example, has damage skills that are corresponding to red gems, while Spider-Man gets a healing ability, but he goes for blue gems. So there's a lot more strategy involved in going after what gems on the field as opposed to your regular match 3 game. And they also have this very interesting new mechanic that certain skills basically turn a gem on the field into a special gem that if, like, I think in one case, like, one gem, it will basically cause damage each turn to the enemy as long as that gem remains on the field. But then there's, like, special attacks. Like, if you don't get this gem off the field in 5 turns, the enemy, you know, uses his sniper rifle or throws a grenade at you, and it does, like, a huge amount of damage. But it sounds cool, but when you go back to this hell system, and as you know, Tom, with these match 3 games, the board is random each time. So if they choose, if the attack gem is, you know, one in the bottom left-hand corner and there's no gems nearby to match with, in 5 turns, the enemy basically gets 300 to 500 points of free damage on it. And that's, you know, time that's going to eat up when this whole match is over, because you don't want to, you know, go into a new battle with guys at 4th or half health. Because you're just sending them to get knocked down, and then you're waiting for an hour for them to recover. And they also have, like, tournaments where if you play, like, these extra hard matches, you unlock points. And whoever gets, like, the highest amount of points at the end of, I think it's like a 6-day or a 10-week, or no, 6-day or 10-day type deal, they get, you know, exclusive cover. They get a very hard to find character. So, on one hand, the whole Marvel property thing is used to such great effect, but that free-to-play is such an annoyance. Such a night and day difference compared to something like Card Hunter, where the microtransactions are there, but they're not in your face like this.
I would also point out Marvel Heroes, also free to play, and they've, for the most part, it's a very non-odious business model. Because what you're describing, Josh, you're talking about the game plan, I'm like, yeah, that sounds interesting. But then I hear about that monetization scheme, and I just realize I want no part of that. That's just... That's something I will never pick up. Yeah.
So with the Marvel Heroes, how is it, like, really in your face about wanting to spend money?
No. I mean, you know, they want you to buy your little goofy costumes if you're into that kind of thing. But where they get you is they give you, I think it's like, there's like 5 or maybe 6 heroes that are free. You can play them up and level them as high as you want. And as you're playing, you pick up these little scraps that you can later use to spend on a new hero. But where they get you is you'll be playing it and you'll be seeing all these other heroes running around, and it's kind of like it's waving underneath your face. Hey, wouldn't you like to be Iron Man? Or, you know, oh, don't you feel like, isn't it time for a little Jean Grey? Or, look, someone's playing Emma Frost. You too could be playing that. So you're constantly having to play alongside these other people with these higher profile characters. You know, you've got Hulk running along beside you. And you sort of think, hey, I want to do that cool stuff he's doing. So you want to go off and buy the Hulk. But it's not, you know, I don't feel it impacts. But for me, what kills this is when the gameplay design, when the design of the game is impacted by the business model. And I feel like Marvel Heroes is a full-featured action RPG that you can play with this free character, and you'll earn points to get other characters as you're playing, without the fundamental design being impacted by them wanting money from you. Okay. It definitely feels like one of the good guys for me as far as free-to-play games.
Now, I remember when you were posting about this during the summer, they did have some pretty nasty issues at the launch. Like, I remember serviceability was a big problem. The game wasn't saving some of your stuff, so you may have spent money and then it gets reacted.
No, what they did to me is they took away my Punisher. So it was just one of those wrong place, wrong time things. You know, I'm like one in a thousand people that this would have happened to, probably even fewer. But it used to be that you would just get a random drop for a character, and you would just keep playing long enough, and you would get one of these random drops, and you would go see what character you got. And that's the only way, short of buying characters, that you could get new characters. And when they were using this model, which has since been abandoned, I found a Punisher, and it was great. And I was like, hey, wow, I got a free character. Awesome. And you feel like you've won something, you know, it's a great victory. And so I was playing the Punisher, and the night I found him, I was just going to dink around and play a little bit, but no, I had my free Punisher, and I leveled him up to like level 8, and I got cool stuff for him, and I logged off, and the next day when I came back, they'd had some issue where they had to roll back the server. And so my free Punisher never even existed. And they do a really bad job of patching and balancing, and because they're not a competitive multiplayer game, they can get away with certain things. You know, it's not like World of Warcraft where people are using their characters in PvP situations as well as PvE situations. They have a beta PvP, but for the most part, this is just a great big sloppy messy Diablo treasure looting whackathon. So, but when they patch stuff, they have a very fast and loose approach to balancing and trying to get things to work, and they'll constantly rebuild the skill trees for some of the characters. And so early on, that, you know, there were some growing pains that they have since moved past.
So each character is essentially their own, like, unique deal. It's not like Wolverine plays the same way as Iron Man.
For the most part. I mean, they have so many characters. I don't know how many. There's probably 30, 40 at this point. There's definitely some overlap, and you can see, you know, there's only a handful of gameplay mechanics in this kind of hack and slash RPG. So you can see how a lot of characters feel very similar. But some of the new ones they're rolling out, like Loki, they just had something called Squirrel Girl, which I'd never heard of. She gets a swarm of squirrels, literally. Like, she's like leads an army of squirrels. So some of the new ones they're rolling out have some cool, unique mechanics. But there are a lot of, I guess what you would call minor characters that probably don't get the same treatment as some of the more higher profile ones.
The free to play, like, general gameplay, is it to the point where if I want to see this character through to the end game, do I need to spend any money on that? Or once a character is yours, you're basically given, you can do anything you want with that one character.
Yep, absolutely. So the only thing that they'll want you to spend money doing is if you want a new outfit. You know, and some of them are pretty egregious. Like, I think there's something like 15 different Iron Man suits, which is like there's the Mark 6 suit and the Mark 42 suit, and then there's the new Mark 51 suit. And it, to me, just looks like, okay, this one has a gold trim here, and that one, the trim is silver, and the red is a little brighter. I mean, I can't tell what's going on with this. So some of them, like Iron Man, has all those little variations. And then some of them, like there's one that there's like Hulk in a gangster suit. Like, he's got a jaunty little fedora on. And I'm like, what is that? So what'll happen, though, is you'll be playing and you'll see someone come along who looks just like you. And because, you know, you're both playing the basic Hulk, and you get this sense of, hey, I you know, it's like showing up at a party and someone wore the same dress. So you that kind of drives you to think, maybe I should get a costume. But no, as far as the free characters go, or as far as once you found or bought with the resource a new character, it's all yours. You know, there's no monetization scheme like, pay a little more to unlock this special bonus for it.
But normally, every character in the game you can buy with real money, is that right?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, they'll sell you as much as you want to pay for. Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, once you have picked from the stable of, I think, 5 free characters, once you've picked the one that you want, if you want any of those other 5, you got to pay for them. You know, you don't get all 5 free. You only get one of the 5 for free.
What's the pricing structure? Like, how much is each hero?
Well, as you can imagine, it's based on who they are. You know, the Thor, you're not going to get Thor cheap right now because Thor's really hot. But, you know, if you want Rocket Raccoon, there's apparently a raccoon superhero. I think he's on the lower end. He's probably, I think, like maybe $6, I think. But if you want Thor, I think he's $15. But you can bet your bottom dollar, Josh Beiser, that when that Guardians of the Galaxy movie comes out, which features Rocket Raccoon, he'll probably be top level $15. Oh, and they just, it's Loki. So yeah, now that Loki is out, I'm sure Loki's a premium character.
Do they have like game sales, or do they have like sales on specific characters or costumes like League of Legends?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, they definitely, when you log in, and that's, I guess that's potentially an annoying thing. When you log in, there's going to be a big old in your face, hey, Deadpool's costumes are 25% off today. Once you're playing, that stuff doesn't bother you. But definitely when you log in, they're going to show you whatever sale is going on. Yeah.
Who developed Marvel Heroes, by the way?
So, David Brevik is a fellow who goes way, way back to, I think even before it was Blizzard North, to, they were called, it's like a big bird, I want to say, not like Dodo or Stork. Dadgummit, what were they called? Well, they were the folks who originally developed Diablo. And dadgummit, what were they called? Blizzard eventually acquired them, then they worked on Diablo 1, Diablo 2.
Blizzard North, I think? Or was that their name when they changed?
That's the name when they changed, but they used to be, I want to say it's the name of a big bird, before they were Blizzard North. Maybe if you can Google that. But so David Brevik is one of the guys. He's from that group. I think it was a couple of them. They formed a new developer called Gazillion. It's Gazillion or Gazillionaire? I think it's Gazillion Studios. And this is their first project. You know, they landed a big license, of course. And I imagine they're just laughing all the way to the bank. I think it's doing very, very well for them. And Toucan? No. What was the name of that?
It's not popping up here.
Fine. Who is the developer of the original Diablo? I feel like as video game journalists, Josh, we should know that.
Yeah, it should like be like homework, I think, or common knowledge.
If you just here, I love this on podcast. Listen to us Google stuff. Mm-hmm. Diablo, go to the game and it'll say who Diablo, the first video game. I'm gonna feel really dumb if it's not a big bird. Originally, let's see, I'm going to click on Blizzard North.
Condor,
see, I got it right. I'm not as dumb as I thought I was.
Yeah, so going back to Marvel Puzzle Quest, as you said with Marvel Heroes, like you feel that there's generally a great game there, and the microtransaction stuff is, you know, it's there, but it's not exactly prevalent to the point where it's in your face saying, hey, you got to buy this or we're not going to let you do it. And I hate to say it, but I can't say the same thing about Marvel Puzzle Quest. Yeah. When I finish a battle, I'm getting a pop-up saying, oh, your guy has to spend the next hour recovering unless, you know, you spend 25 points or 50 points and buy a first aid kit. Or, this battle's really hard. Why don't you buy a boost for 50 points that lets your red blocks do 50% more damage? Or my favorite, oh, you like this character, but you can't find any colors for it. Oh, guess you can't really use her until get lucky, or could spend like $5 and hopefully get a drop. Or
what
actually,
system are you playing this on, Josh?
On the PC. It was, I think, released, I know it's been on iOS for a while, and I think it was just put on Steam, I would say, I think last week, but I don't know for sure.
So one of the regulars on my podcast, a fellow named Brandon Kukowski-Schnell, he comes from a site called No High Scores, we had an on-podcast intervention when he was playing this game. He explained how, you know, he liked some of it, but he thought the monetization system was insidious. So we had an intervention where on the air, we had him delete it from his iPad. Josh Spicer, I would like to now ask you on the air to uninstall this Marvel Puzzle Quest thing. Are you up to that, or are you at the stage where you're insisting you don't have a problem?
At this point, I don't think I have a problem, but I think I will have to install Marvel Heroes just to try that one.
Before we do that, maybe you should right now, we could walk you through the steps, Josh. We could just have you go to Control Panel, uninstall, and then select Marvel Puzzle Quest, or maybe you could do it from Steam. I just think it's the best thing for you and for the industry, Josh.
All right, I guess I'll do it.
Really? Okay, I want you to talk us through this. Let's right now, on the air, live, go ahead, tell us as you're doing it, talk us through it. We want to hear you step-by-step uninstalling Marvel Puzzle Quest and saying no to insidious free-to-play monetization schemes. Talk us through this. What's going on right now, Josh Spicer?
All right, I'm looking at my list of hundreds of Steam games. I see okay. Marvel Puzzle Quest.
Good.
Apparently, it's right next to Mark of the Ninja.
Okay, right-click on that now, mm-hmm. and then go to Delete Local Content. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you doing it?
Yeah.
Is it happening?
It'll say, are you sure you want to do this?
Of yes, course. Tell it yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now it's doing something. Now it's saying it's uninstalling, and it is now off my Steam list.
Josh, we're very proud of you.
Yeah.
I know I speak for everyone listening to this podcast, and I say this is a good day for you. We'll come back in a year, and we'll see about giving you your 1 year coin for a year free from Marvel Puzzle Quest.
And now we'll have to try Marvel Heroes out and see how that is.
Do you like Diablo type game? Like action RPGs? Yeah, I think you'll like Marvel Heroes.
And of course, with the Marvel Puzzle Quest, like the monetization, I guess one thing I forgot to point out that you can unlock a character's skill without finding their cover, but that costs 125 hero points, which I'm not even going to bother trying to figure out how much real dollars that is. Mm. And I think one of like the telltale signs for me with any of these games when the monetization is that bad is when they give you, you know, the different amounts of in-game currency you can buy. You can't just buy the amount you want. You have to buy these little packs. I always love when they have, you know, like the $200 pack or the $100 of these points. I'm just saying to myself, in what world would I spend $100 not on actual content per se, but on the means to buy more stuff? It's that same type of deal that I hate with trying to buy, like, Xbox Live points.
Right.
That it just annoys the hell out of me, because what they're basically doing is they're trying to soften the blow when you're buying more stuff, saying, you know, it's not $100, it's, you know, 50 quads or whatever the hell they call it. As a quick thing, we were going to talk a little bit about the strategy genre, but just as a quick bit of news, Planetary Annihilation, which is the game that I know that I'm waiting for. Tom, have you been checking that one out?
Again, as a fellow who would rather wait until games are done, I'm certainly looking forward to seeing how it ends up. But no, I haven't looked at any of the early builds.
Yeah, so they said when they did the Kickstarter last year, I think it's been just about a year since they did it, that they were going to aim for a December release. And there's been talk, people are saying, you know, the game's not done, it's not at a point where, you know, there's no way it can just go from here to release. So Uber announced last week that they are officially moving the release date back to when it's done. So they're going to work on it for the foreseeable future and hopefully get everything in that they want, which I think is a great move for them because they're one of the few Kickstarters that basically accomplish every one of their stretch goals. So from what they were originally pitching, which was, you know, one planet type, two players flying it out, now they've got multiple planet types. They're going for like a metagame like skirmish mode, and they're still adding more units in. I've been playing the beta build. I have no idea what version they're up to. They basically opened it up to anyone who pre-ordered or kickstarted the game can now play the beta build, and of course that will translate into the real version that gets released eventually. And I think I agree with their decision. It's fun, but it's nowhere near a point that I would declare it as rave prime time. I would say a big thing, especially coming for someone like you who enjoys strategy game, is right now there's literally no UI. There's no way to actually like see easily what's going on or how everything is.
It's kind of important.
Yeah, and I had enough trouble with StarCraft 2, and they actually had a UI, so I need something to sort of help me or sort of tell me, you know, hey, my guys over on the East Continent aren't doing anything, or hey, my resources aren't working right now. And that just killed me with StarCraft 2. I just found that so frustrating to play. They demand so much micromanagement that it just drove me to not even play a game multiplayer. I enjoyed single player, but I just, my days of trying to become the best StarCraft 2 player in the world have been dashed.
Plus, we all know, Josh, that your real strength is in Payday 2 and Left 4 Dead.
Yeah, so I'm ready either for a zombie apocalypse or become a thief, one or the other. Okay, so, Tom, I think we can end here. It was great talking to you for the last 2 hours.
Thank you for having me, Josh.
Yep, and I'll love to have you on again or to make a return trip to the Core to 3Cast.
Absolutely.
For those of you listening, thank you for tuning in this week. And as always, if you're interested in contributing to Game Wisdom, either writing a piece for the site or for being a future guest, feel free to send me an email. You can find the information under Submission Want on the front page. That will take you to the contact link as well as the guidelines for writing. So with that said, have a great week and we will talk to you again next week. Take care.